It's a pleasure to welcome Tamar Wiseman, who is speaking from the Galil, I believe, right? The Galil,
yes.
I don't know, living on a farm in the Galil and working on sustainable agriculture. I don't know, how many years are you living there?
We're in our eighth year now.
Your eighth year, wow. And she does serve, I mean, unfortunately now it's a slow business, but as a tour guide in Israel, lectures in Tanakh and the Eretz Yisrael, and their book, Tribal Lands, the 12 Tribes of Israel in Their Ancestral Territories. So you're in which shape? where are you living?
I actually am on the seam line between Naphtali and Yisachar. On my morning walk,
okay.
I cross over from one territory to another.
Very nice. And she just finished her second book, The Bible's Wild Child, on Midrashic Patterns in the Book of Shoftim. And it's a pleasure to welcome her to make a Shechayanu as her first talk at Torah in Motion. So, Bavakasha Tamar, we'll give you the full 40 minutes, so you're allowed to go 2.5 minutes over. Bavakasha.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much. It's an honor and a privilege to be here. Is it good to get started now?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So, Chanukah Sameach, or Erev Chanukah Sameach. Happy Chanukah to everyone. The topic I decided to speak on tonight is the city of Modi'in. I entitled the Shiur Modi'in, City of Chanukah. Can everybody see the screen? Okay.
Yeah.
And that is a topic that can be taken in numerous different directions. If I was wearing my tour guiding hat, then we could talk about the probable location of ancient Modi'in, which is the center of the story, the origin story of Chanukah, where Chanukah was launched, so to speak, the city of Matityahu and his five sons. We're not going to be delving into that tonight, although there is much to be said about the potential candidates for the location of ancient Modi'in. We alternatively could talk about some of the stories that are centered around Modi'in that I had, the aforementioned Matityahu and his sons. That's also not our topic tonight. This shiur is about Inyana Diyoma, the essence of the holiday of Chanukah as seen through the lens of place. And the place of Chanukah is Modi'in. And there's not so much to be said about Modi'in in the rabbinic sources. There are a few references to Modi'in in the Mishnah and a few more in the Talmud. And so I'd just like to do a quick survey of where Modi'in is found in the rabbinic sources, because that will launch us into a deeper understanding of the concept of this place. So the first source I don't even bring for you here. That's more of a tangential reference to the city of Modi'in through some of the Hasmonean kings. So the Hasmonean kings were descendants of Matityahu and his sons, and they are linked to the city of Modi'in in the Talmud, and also as had been mentioned in the previous shiur and in earlier shiurim, I'm sure, in the apocryphal works of the four books of Maccabees and in Josephus, and there's plenty to link the Chanukah story to Modi'in. But I'd like to just get into the two Mishnayot, the two Mishnayot from different tractates in Mishnah that are very similar conceptually, and both mention Modi'in. And I'd like to try and use those Mishnayot to arrive at a deeper idea of what the city is about and how the city can inform the holiday, as it were, to help us understand the holiday a bit better. So let's first look at this Mishnah in Chagiga, the Mishnah, which is the backbone of the oral law, redacted right around the corner from me in Sipori in the beginning of the 3rd century CE. And this is from the tractate Chagiga. So let's examine the opening of this Mishnah. Min hamodi'it belifnim. Modi'it, Modi'in, Modi'im, these are all interchangeable terms. From the village of Modi'in and inwards, ne'emanin al klei cheres. One can trust the potter in his observance of the purity laws, which were necessary to ensure that pottery, which was the plasticware of the ancient world, did not was not contaminated with any kind of impurity. So the potter himself had to be trustworthy. And as long as the potter was located somewhere in the radius of Modi'in towards Jerusalem, anywhere within that radius, Modi'in established the distance, then he was trustworthy. And so what we're starting to see here, and it will be further developed in the next Mishnah, is that there's some kind of an intrinsic relationship between Jerusalem and Modi'in. Modi'in forms the outermost point in which we can still somehow be connected back to Jerusalem. So anyone who is producing pottery, let's say in Motza, or Kiryat Ya'arim, or anywhere within the distance, again, take the whole circumference of the distance between Modi'in. I don't know if everyone here is familiar with modern Modi'in. It's around, let's say, 30 modern miles from Jerusalem. And most assumptions are that that's in that vicinity of modern Modi'in is what we're talking about here. Anywhere from that radius, let's say between 25 and 30 miles, is trustworthy. So any you take that radius out of Jerusalem, and anyone who's producing pottery can be trusted that the pottery is kosher pottery and can be used. Let's see if we can build off of that same concept with another Mishnah, the second Mishnah that mentions Modi'in. And this is a Mishnah in the Tractate of Psachim. Now, the context of this Mishnah is talking about a derech rechoka, a faraway location that would make it okay for someone who could not make it to Jerusalem in time to offer the Passover sacrifice. He would have a reprieve and be able to offer it the following month. That's called Pesach Sheni. So either someone who wasn't ritually pure at the time of the offer of the Passover sacrifice on the 14th going into the 15th of Nisan could then have a month reprieve and offer it a month later. Either if he wasn't pure or if he was coming from too far away, like where I live in Ste'ilan, we are definitely considered far away. Because look at how the Mishnah defines a distant path. Ezohi derech rechoka. What is the definition of a distant journey? Min ha-modi'in v'lachutz. Anywhere that is outside of Modi'in. So my brother who lives in Modi'in would not be able to warrant this exemption. I, who live up in the Galil, would be able to take advantage of that extra month, and I have the reprieve, and I can then bring my Paschal sacrifice a month later. But notice that in both of these Mishnayot, the concept that's being delivered is that Modi'in is the furthest most location that is still somehow connected to Jerusalem. And so anything from Modi'in inwards towards Jerusalem is not considered to have this exemption of a distant path. Or with the first Mishnah that we saw, it is considered to be a location of trustworthiness. So here we're left with this concept that, somehow links Jerusalem to Modi'in. And I'd like to take this idea a little bit further in another direction, where there is another Talmudic source that links Modi'in back to Jerusalem. It's a little bit more abstruse, but let's look at it together. I'm in source number 3 now, in the Tractate of Ta'anit. And in this source, the Gemara is discussing the very last gasp of Jerusalem on the eve of its destruction. Amru, Ksheharav Beit HaMikdash, when the temple was destroyed in the first time, back in 586 BCE by the Babylonians. Oto hayom tisha ba'av haya. It was the ninth of Av. Motzei Shabbat haya. It was the conclusion of Shabbat. Motzei Shvi'it haya. It was the conclusion of the Shemitah year. All of these endings are all culminating. They're all coming together and culminating in the destruction of the temple. U'mishmarta shel Yehoyariv haita. And it was also the shift of the priestly family of Yehoyariv. Now, there were many priests, and the priests lived scattered all throughout the land of Israel, and they would work in the temple in shifts called mishmarot. And the last priestly family to work in the temple just before it was destroyed was the family of Yehoyariv. Now, how is this in any way linked to Modi'in? I don't have Modi'in anywhere in my source here. So for that, I would turn to the first book of Maccabees, which is the most trustworthy, having been written just a couple of decades after the actual series of Maccabean wars. And let's see what we have here, which is corroborated by Josephus. Bayamim hahem, in those days, haya kohen b'Yisrael, ushmo Matityahu ben Yochanan ben Shimon. Now, we're familiar with Matityahu, the great patriarch of the Hashmonaim. But what priestly family was he linked to? Mibnei Yehoyariv b'Yerushalayim. So he was from the family of Yehoyariv. V'hu yoshev b'har Moda'it. And he lived in Modi'in. So here, obliquely, the Talmud is indicating another link between Modi'in and Yerushalayim. So I'm starting to see a pattern developing here. First with the first two Mishnayot, which seem to almost, I think of it as a rubber band. You have Jerusalem as the center, and how far can you stretch that rubber band before it breaks, before you enter into a new category, either untrustworthiness or too distant from Jerusalem? That point is Modi'in. Modi'in is the farthest you can get from Jerusalem while still maintaining some kind of an intrinsic connection to Jerusalem. And then here I see as well, through the family of Yehoyariv, Matityahu being from the family of Yehoyariv and Matityahu living in Modi'in, another link between Modi'in and Jerusalem. Now, if we keep that for a second on the back burner, that there is some kind of intrinsic connection and that this shiur is devoted to exploring that connection, I'd like to just ask about the name Modi'in, because names often give some kind of an indication of the essence of a person or of a place. So if we were to look at the name Modi'in, if I were to look at it, if I were to be in the university, or if I were to be working as a tour guide, which hopefully I'll get back to, more tourists coming, God willing, that would be wonderful. Were I to be in either of those two contexts, I would say Modi'in was likely called Modi'in because of its location, because it stands at the crossroads of two or even three very traversed and traveled roads, either leading from Jaffa over to Jerusalem, or leading from points further north, ports further north, over to points further south on a north-south axis. But Modi'in is almost like that signpost that has a lot of those spokes pointing out, saying, go this way, because Modi'in is from the language of ladat, to know, or lehodia, to make known. This is your information booth. This is where you go to figure out, well, this way to Jerusalem, and that way to Shechem, and that way down to Hebron, and that way over to Yafo. And it's kind of that very well located location. And I'm sure that could be corroborated by those of you who live in Modi'in or who have visited Modi'in can realize it's one of the best located cities in modern Israel as well as in ancient Israel. But I would also like to suggest that that the idea of da'at, of knowledge, goes beyond just telling me how to get to Jerusalem or how to get to Yafo. I'd like to suggest that dot means something specific. Now, I understand that dot can be taken, that concept of knowledge, for which we have numerous words in Hebrew, can be taken in different conceptual directions. I would just like to choose the direction of the Yerushalmi. And here, look with me, please, in source number 5, which will help us arrive at a deeper understanding of what Modi'in might mean and indicate for Hanukkah. Rabbi Amar, in the context of discussing on the tefillot, the prayers of Shabbat, now you know in Shabbat there's a special Amidah, there's a special prayer that we do that is not like the Amidah, the Shmona Esrei, the central prayer of the week. It is a shortened version. It incorporates some of the weekly prayers, but it also shifts and changes to Shabbat-oriented prayer. And so Rebbe, again, my neighbor, who spent quite a bit of time between Beit She'arim and Tzipori up here in the Lower Galilee, Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi, he was curious about something that maybe you're curious about as well. In the Amidah Shabbat, we don't have the prayer thanking God for giving us wisdom, for Chonen Hadat. And Rebbe puts it this way. He says, Heach bitlu Chonen Hadat b'Shabbat. How is it that we eliminated this prayer to God, he who grants us knowledge on Shabbat? Kim ein dea tfila minayin. If we don't have knowledge, then how do we pray? It's a fundamental rhetorical question. And then he asks another rhetorical question, which I think is the key to understanding Modi'in. V'cho em ein dea havdala minayin. And if one doesn't have da'at, if one doesn't have dea, if one doesn't have Modi'in, then how can one distinguish between different entities? In the concept of the Yerushalmi, dea means havdala. It means the ability to make distinction and distinguish between different things. That's in our Havdalah prayer, with which we end the Sabbath, with which we end Shabbat, where we bless God who has given us the ability to distinguish between holy and profane, and between the 6 days of the week and Shabbat, etc. And so, if we take this idea that dat means havdalah, means the ability to distinguish between different entities, then I would argue that we only need to exercise our faculty of havdalah when we're dealing with very similar elements. You don't need to really use da'at to tell the difference between my second grade little leaguer and Joe DiMaggio, right? Like we're dealing with two different playing fields here. Da'at demands that there be two things so similar that we have to exercise our critical ability to distinguish between them. And so I'd like to, on that note, and I'll if there are any questions, I will get to them at the end of this year. On that note, I'd like to identify what it is in Chanukah, which is represented by the city of Da'at, the city of Modi'in, that demands that we exercise this critical faculty of da'at, of being able to distinguish between such like entities. And in order to do so, I would look to another Mishnah, then, and hopefully at the end of this shiur, I'll be able to explain why I'm dealing so much with Mishnayot in a shiur on Chanukah. Another Mishnah that is a very, very startling Mishnah. Every time I learn it, I am startled anew. And it is a Mishnah, and here you can see with me, look along in source number 7, a Mishnah Masechet Megillah, that says basically that if I want to write a Torah scroll, then I have a choice to write it either in Lashon HaKodesh, which is the Torah scrolls, the Sifrei Torah that we're all familiar with, or I can write it in Greek, in the language of the Yevanim, in the language of the Hellenists, and it would, for all halachic intents and purposes, be considered a kosher Torah scroll. Now, this is quite astounding. And the reason, as the Gemara goes on to explain this Mishnah, the reason why this would be something that would be permitted is based on the Septuagint. I don't know if you've had a shiur in this series, in this Yom Iyun, on the Septuagint, on the Greek translation of the Torah, but as told to us in various different apocryphal, pseudepigraphal, and rabbinic sources, in other words, the our corpus of rabbinic literature is helped along by extra biblical and extra rabbinic sources, some of which were discussed in the previous shiur. These are sources that attest to, including in our Gemara here, that I didn't bring for you in the source sheet, but trust me on this, attest to the miracle of the translation of the Torah into Greek, where the king Ptolemy, who was a Hellenistic king of the Ptolemaid kings in Egypt, to build his library in Alexandria. He had the rabbis, he sequestered 72 rabbis, each in his own cell, and said, translate the Torah. And the great miracle, as delivered to us in the version, in the Talmud, of this translation, was that all of the rabbis, though each was isolated, came out with the same translation. And that translation is known as the Targum HaShivim, the translation of the 70. It's a rounded number from 72, or the Septuagint in Greek. And because of the holiness of this translation, the miracle involved in the translation, that would warrant this halacha, essentially. This is why a Torah can be written in Greek. And it was decided by halachic decisors through the ages that this is the halacha. Rambam, Maimonides, in his Code of Jewish Law, in discussing the laws of Sefer Torah, he upholds this halacha that's delivered in the Mishnah and says, yes, were we to have the original Targum HaShivim, the original Septuagint, then we could have a kosher Torah scroll written in Greek letters, in the Greek language. And when the Baal Koreh went up to read from the Torah scroll, then he could read it in Greek. However, we have lost the original version of the Ur text of the Septuagint. And so therefore, the only kosher Torah scroll is that which is written with the Masoretic Hebrew text. So halachically, we do not practice like this, but Rambam did preserve the core of this halacha that, yes, were we to have the original Septuagint, we could write the Torah scroll in Greek. I will leave. I have this wonderful book. I studied Greek in college with a chassid in Bnei Brak by the name of David Shaps. I was in touch with him recently. Every Hanukkah, I pulled this out because I'm reminded of the joy that he had over Hanukkah when he would sing he would sing, I believe it was a translation of Mo'oz Tzor into Greek. He wouldn't sing it in the tune that we use, but he would sing the Greek because he wanted us to appreciate the beauty of Greek. And that is what is considered the essence of the power of Greece and of the essence of the beauty of Greece is the language, which can permeate our tense, so to speak. And that is essentially what we have to contend with. I'd like to, instead of paraphrasing it, I'd like to look at the language of the Maharal and how he explains this power of Greece and how it stands contra to the power of Israel. So as he puts it, Ha'uma hazot bikshu sheyichtavu lehen chachamim ha'Torah yevanit. Now you can read along in English that he retells the story of the Septuagint where the Greeks sought to have the Torah translated. Af ki bevadai ein l'uma hazot chelek b'Torah, even though the Greek nation, the Hellenists, certainly had no portion in the Torah, u'mikol makom bikshu lechtov lehem ha'Torah b'lashon shelahem. And nevertheless, they wanted for their library of all wisdom in Alexandria that our holy texts be translated into Greek. And Rabbi the Maharal in the 16th century is writing that this teaches us that of all of the nations of the world, it is the Greeks that are considered to be the repository of knowledge and the fathers of Western knowledge. And this is why our sages said, in the blessing that Noah gave to his son Japheth, to his son Yefet, who is the forefather of Greece, Yaftalukim li Yefet v'yishkon be'ahalei Shem. This is the blessing that the beauty of Yefet, the beauty of Greece, shall dwell in the tents of Shem. And what does this mean? This means that Yofuto shall Yefet, the beauty of Greece, is dwelling in the tents of Shem, meaning that the language of Greece, which is exceptionally beautiful, should dwell in the Batei Midrashot and in the Batei Knesset, the synagogues and the learning halls, the Ohalei Shem, that tents of Shem, that we bring in the beauty of Greece to dwell in our holiest places. You can just read along here. I'll just read the English translation, which is to say, from the beauty of the children of Yafet, which is the Greek language, which is exceedingly beautiful. And while the Torah dwells in the tents of Shem, it is permissible to have the Torah in Greek. And this is because the Greeks have exceeding wisdom compared to all nations. I'll switch over here to I'll continue on in the English. And this comparative closeness itself was the cause of them wanting to annihilate the Torah. For a man is not become jealous except of a man who resembles himself. So, in gibor mitkane ela begibor shekmoto. You don't put a second grade little leaguer over and against Joe DiMaggio. It is the wisdom of Greece that stands counter to the wisdom of the Torah. These are two, dare I say, now I'm not going to dare to say, I will say, extraordinarily powerful repositories of wisdom. And the challenge of Dat, symbolized through Modi'in, the city of Hanukkah, the challenge of Dat is to be able to make that distinction very carefully. Not necessarily to banish Aristotle and Plato and Socrates from our bookshelves, but to incorporate the beauty of Greece into our libraries. And again, this powerful halakha of the language of Greece being able to find its place in our holiest of texts is very compelling. However, lest I just leave it at that and give carte blanche for my Sfarim to dwell side by side, I'd like to think a little bit more deeply about those Mishnayot that launched us In this Odyssey. I use that word very carefully, homage to Homer there. In this Odyssey of understanding Modi'in and Da'at. Now, to do that, I would like to look at the pre-tzaddik, Rav Tzadok HaKohen Melublin, and see how he frames this. The pre-tzaddik says the following. Now, he's saying that the main spread of the oral Torah began in this age of Matityahu and the Hashmonaim. The oral Torah being the ability to distinguish between elements.
Can you put the phone down, please?
Hello?
Phone down.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Being able to distinguish between different elements, as the Maharal puts it, the Mishnah, Mikra, Mishnah, Ugmara, the Torah and the Mishnah and the Gemara stand in parallel to the three definitions of wisdom. The Torah would be Chokhmah, it's a divine wisdom. Mishnah would be Da'at. That's why I kept on bringing Mishnayot over the course of this shiur.